I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Oh, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, y'all, introducing Dr. Simone Chun. She is on the steering committee of the Alliance of Scholars Concerned About Korea and is a member of the Korea Policy Institute and the Korea Peace Network. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. And a couple of recent articles of yours of interest. First of all, toward a truly indigenous peace in the Korean Peninsula. It's time that American politicians, both Democratic and Republicans, give Koreans a chance to shape their own destiny. And, well, what an important point to even come from in the first place, because the narrative on TV news here is that stupid, evil, horrible Donald Trump is trying to do a thing. And so, therefore, it must be horrible and we all should oppose it, even if it's peace talks. And so, but what you're saying here is that this is North and South Korea, and their governments are really leading this parade. What's unique about Donald Trump is he's decided to not try to stop them, as Obama or Bush would have done.
Mm-hmm. You know, Professor Noam Chomsky pointed out that this is the somewhat a unique opportunity because this is, very first time the two Koreas in the driver. You know, driving the peace process. And Donald Trump has done one thing, that is attending a meeting, a summit meeting. And in spite of all those, hardline rhetoric that he had for almost a year, and the fact that he did agree with one thing that no American president ever done, that is to meet with the North Korean leader. So that is a pretty significant. And so as you pointed out, I mean, as a Korean and also I have lived in the United States for more than 20 years, and a lot of people around, my friends and colleagues, and most of them are actually progressive Democrats who will not necessarily support, Republican or Republican president. But on this issue, because of the peace, the issue of peace and war in the Korean Peninsula is so significant. And this, we're talking about 68 years of the Korean War that has not ended, as you know. And so it's time to really, to support this amazing initiative that the two Koreas are engaging. And but it's very still frustrating, as you mentioned, and also I including myself and Americans, there is a very sort of a strong opposition against the a permanent peace settlement on the Korean Peninsula. So I'm just hoping that I'm great to have this opportunity and will be happy to answer more questions concerning the issue.
Yeah. Well, so now to go back a little bit, and I think, most of my listeners are familiar with this, but at the time when George W. Bush took power in 2001, we already had a nuclear deal with North Korea. And at that time, they had been moving toward opening more relations in the Clinton years, but then they ran out of time on the Clinton years. And then when the Bush administration came in, Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, had said, we have a pretty good deal with North Korea and we want to keep it. But he was soon overruled by Dick Cheney and our current national security advisor, John Bolton, and others who worked to destroy that agreed framework deal, which ended up just pushing North Korea out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and toward nuclear weapons. It was only then that they began making nuclear weapons. And then the Bush administration after that, and then the Obama administration as well, they both had the so-called principle that only after the a nuclear issue is resolved, as Bush put it, only after they give up the nukes that he pushed them to get in the first place, only then can we get to talking about ending the war, any kind of reunification or anything like that. And it sounds like, I mean, is it right that that's really something that, Trump is saying we can basically negotiate all these things rather than saying you must comply 100% with my nuclear deal before you get anything else. He's saying we can go ahead with recognition. We can go ahead with allowing, not that America's leading it, but he's allowing the North and the South to negotiate on the question of a real peace treaty to end the war and this kind of thing, kind of all as one sort of process, rather than having the technicality, the deal killer that Bush and Obama built into it. Is that pretty much a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment. However, I'm not quite, I don't think that there is still a clear sense of what Trump administration is going to do. You know, there's a lot within the Trump administration who are also divided, and especially, people are very, and we are very concerned about the Don Bolton wing, as demanding denuclearization first and trying to be sort of, very obstructionist in the any diplomatic settlement. And going back to, I think the one thing very important is to sort of debunk this myth that North Korea is the one that poses threat, and so I think this is something we think about it. If you remember, it is actually the United States that has been sort of obstructing this any progress on the Korean Peninsula. Even as you recall, peace treaty should have been signed in 1953. Actually, 90 days within the signing of the armistice, the Korea is still technically at war. And if you look at the history and record, it is again and again the United States that has actually stopping, obstructing peace process in the Korean Peninsula. Even let's say talk about the nuclear issue here. Is that North Korea that it is a trigger? I mean, the United States, decided to introduce nuclear weapons into South Korea in 1956. That was violating the armistice agreement, and all the way up to 1991. And so this is where we're talking about in North Korea, constantly this sort of the way image is portrayed in the United States. The media is this evil empire, and not empire, evil, and the very, you cannot have a biased opinion, objective opinion. And so North Korea is basically under the threat of U.S. nuclear threat for more than half a century. So that is the context that we have to understand. And even now, in spite of all the very historic peace process that has been occurring, you have within the United States, we have a really, truly powerful opposition forces. It's not just some hardline neocon analysts or, within the administration, but also the, it's very surprising, the Democratic members of Congress. That are almost taking John Bolton's type of neocon argument, and they are, that their position is basically, we're not going to support anything Trump, proposes, or North Korea must denuclearize first, and then we can talk about anything. So there is I'm not going to underestimate the importance of to Korea's taking the initiative, but on the other hand, the United States is obstructing the peace settlement in Korea, which lasting for more than half a century. And this is, I find, is more serious and more difficult a challenge than anything that I have seen. And that's why I think it is really important that we really have to inform and educate the public, raise awareness.
Yeah. Well, that sure is right. And obviously it makes sense that you would have, liberals and Democrats knee-jerking against mm-hmm. the president. But to have the entire center, and including the liberals, And not really the leftists. I differentiate between real leftists and, I guess, real progressives and the liberals who are less principled, closer to the center. Where they team up with John Bolton to really try to stop this, to do nothing but disparage this effort in every way. Mm-hmm. And you know, they really have let their agenda shown, too, in their panic. I'm sure you're familiar with this, where the Korea expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies tweeted out back, I guess, as soon as Trump announced that he would even hold the Singapore meeting. It may have been after that, but I think it was as soon as he announced that he would hold the Singapore meeting, that, oh, no, but if we have peace on the Korean Peninsula and an end to the crisis there, then that will take away our excuse for having our troops there.
And, exactly.
And so that is the end. And the crisis is the means. And they would rather keep the crisis, even when the crisis means literal nuclear brinksmanship between Kim and Donald Trump, threatening fire and fury and testing intercontinental ballistic missiles, that still you don't want to take that threat away, or else what's our reason for having 30,000 troops there? That's the way they think about it. And they don't even know to be embarrassed about that. They don't know that that's supposed to be their secret motivation and that they're supposed to lie to us about what's going on. They admit it, that that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I actually happened to be visiting a Democratic senator's office right after the Singapore summit. I was in the D.C. And I was shocked. They were, I mean, we're talking about within 24 hours of the summit, right? And these Democratic senators, we're not talking about Republicans, right? I again highlight Democratic senators. And their response was, in a way, from raising something, very sort of disappointed, and that they thought that, you know, there's nothing in it that is concrete. And another expressed was just, you know, it's a very extreme. Just they didn't even want to, you know, take time and to evaluate. They were ready to say this was a failure, right? And so that was truly amazing. And so you are right. What happened is that. So I was talking to some of those, for instance, Senator Menendez's office, and they were saying, because I was telling them about, you know, how the Korea sovereignty, and as a Korean, I think it's very important. I was talking about the family, separated family members, the inter-Korean process is important. And the staff member to Senator Menendez responded, oh, yeah, I think it's great. Okay, and we understand President Moon has done a great job. And then he said, but the only thing, the most important thing for us is America's security interest. And then when I made asked him to more be in detail specific, what come down was the American troops, you know, from 28,000 or 32,000 American troops stationed in Korea. So that is the main, you know, the most important one as far as the United States is concerned. And then if you think, well, why are they so concerned about those American troops? So which come down to the Korean problem? That is, you know, this issue is in Korea. This is not about two Korea. This is not actually about North Korea. This is about United States hegemonic interest, right? The maintaining and securing hegemony in Northeast Asia. It's actually, you're talking about against the China, against the Russia. That is the fundamental interest. So two Koreas is sort of a means, for America to, you know, maintain those troops. And even still this day. And so this is why, in a way, you know, people who were looking at this, you know, some people think it's great to solve this crisis and have a peace. On the other hand, those people are, you know, literally like freaking out, and they're very concerned that there may be any peace, and then there will even, you know, sort of can eliminate the need for American troops there. So you're absolutely right. That is why it is, you know, the process has been going on this long, and it still has faced major challenges.
The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by books, particularly Kesslyn Runs, a new dystopian novel about the very near future by the great Charles Featherstone. Kesslyn Runs. Also, No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Bodakchani
and the War State by Mike Swanson about the rise of the military-industrial complex in America after World War II. He also gives great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get some precious metals, gold and silver and et cetera, from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's at rrbi.co. rrbi.co. Also, check out Zencash at zencash.com or zensystem.io. It's a great digital currency, but it's also a messaging app and a document transfer app and all kinds of great stuff, too. Learn all about it at zencash.com. And then there's Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. If you sign up from the link on my page at scotthorton.org, I'll get a little bit of a kickback there. And check this out. Speaking of scotthorton.org, if you'd like expanddesigns.com to build you a new 2018 model website, go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Also, don't forget the bumpersticker.com. Stickers for your band or your business at very reasonable prices. High quality stuff there. It used to be my company back when. Thebumpersticker.com. Really is something to see. In fact, I should go find this quote and really write this down so I have it for, you know, with a footnote and everything. But I saw in one of these conversations with these experts on Twitter saying that, you know, really the troops in Korea, just as you just said, the troops in Korea, they're not really there for North Korea. They're to keep them out, even as the tripwire for war on behalf of the South. They're really there for China. And that's why we need them there. And that's why we need our troops in Okinawa and wherever else is to hem in China. Although, you know, there's not enough troops in Korea, Okinawa, Australia, and the entire Pacific to really do anything to threaten China. I mean, our Navy, I guess, can threaten them. But the actual infantry that we have, you know, quote unquote, available aren't enough to land on the coast anywhere in China. I mean, that's crazy, right? So the whole thing's kind of bogus, but they've talked themselves into believing it. And, you know, I'm reminded, I just read this book, The Doomsday Machine by Daniel Ellsberg. And there's such insight in that book of just what it means to be a bureaucrat. And especially, you know, his job was planning nuclear war. But it just goes to show the way that they think, well, we've, you know, got this game theory equation that says that this is how we should do it. And so to you and me, it sounds crazy. You're sitting here talking about reunifying families. Well, that doesn't fit in our algorithm. You know, that's not the way we look at this. This is about threatening Beijing, right? And and so what seems like, you know, the basic human concern or even the national interest of the American people, as we would see it, doesn't really have much to do with it. It's, as you said, these games of hegemony.
Exactly. That's why, you know, it's very important to, I mean, you know, I've studied, I teach international relations, and I, you know, studied all those game theory. And even, you know, the Vietnam War, how, you know, as you look at it, so the Vietnam War was completely designed, theorized by these the game theorists, these guys in the lab, right? It has nothing to do with reality at the cost of millions of, you know, innocent, you know, people. And that is why it's, I was going to say, you know, some of the peace activists trying so hard to put human face on the Korean conflict, even as you see, you know, this this week's event, that is a reunion of a divided family members. I mean, we're talking about those, you know, 10 million Koreans who were separated from the Korean War at the time. And, you know, a lot of still hundreds of thousands of people. And if you look at those, you know, the reunion event, I mean, people literally, I mean, there's a mother who is for the first time seeing, you know, her son and, you know, a man who is, old, you know, like 9-year-old man for the first time meeting his, you know, family. And after having waited for 68 years, they get to have only 11-hour meeting. And that's it. They will never be able to see their loved one again. And so this is a humanitarian crisis. And that's why I think it's very important to, you know, to somewhat contest this mainstream media's the portrayal of the crisis. The only thing they talk about is nuclear weapon. However, we have to understand the origins of this country issue, and could really, you know, so bring the human, you know, side of this story.
Right.
Well, and you know,
and also one more thing I want to mention about the, you know, about, I just remember something, you know, the again a little bit of, you know, the earlier point about the American security establishment interest, mm-hmm. all this military industrial complex, their main concern that is having permanently, you know, sort of colonizing South Korea, is that, you know, you probably already know that, you know, we just South Korea just helped build the largest U.S. overseas military base, you know, came Humphrey, which is open just now. And we, you know, South Korea spent, what is it, like 90% of that cost, that is $10.8 billion. And why would you need, you might want to ask, you know, why would you need the largest U.S. overseas military base in South Korea, right? And we have in Jeju Island, there's, you know, very most beautiful island in South Korea. There's they just built, as you probably know, naval base, which you can have all this nuclear submarine and all can be, you know, operate. And they just finished that about 2 years ago. So if you put these facts, development, the Korean Peninsula is still at the very heart of this, you know, the sort of Cold War. And that is why this process is not just about North Korea. This is that we really have to understand the big picture. And to some extent, I think that those people in Korea who still trying to be diplomatic and try to convince Trump administration to, you know, have some result with the peace process in North Korea, is saying that, you know, even for the don't look at North Korea just as sort of enemy. Look at the entire Korea as, in a way, maybe it's strategically important for United States, strategic interest in Northeast Asia. And, I mean, this is a little more complicated issue, but I can talk about more later another time. But still, the big picture is that we have to have a very, you know, clear geopolitical, broader context of the crisis, not just North Korea, who's developing, you know, this nuclear weapon and posing a threat to right. the entire world.
Right. Well, I mean, no, you're exactly right. Of course, if just fair was fair, then mm-hmm. people would see that America has everything to give and nothing to lose here. You know, the idea that we're mm-hmm. supposed to just continue to sanction and blockade until, you know, forever comes and one day the regime falls. The people who said the regime was about to fall have said that since the Soviet Union fell. And it hasn't mm-hmm. happened yet. It's been more than 25 years. And, you know, so opposite of the Soviet model is the mm-hmm. China model, where Nixon and Kissinger just went over there and shook hands with Mao and said, let's end the Cold mm-hmm. War. And so, you know, China's had nukes this whole time, and nobody cares because we're friends with them now for 40 years, and mm-hmm. it's been fine. And so, you know, when you hear, we hear critics all the time, you know, the Fox News version, well, now that Donald Trump's the president, I guess their tune has changed, but the Fox News version of this would be that, you know, it's a totalitarian state. You can't deal with them, but that, no. Yes, it's a totalitarian state, of course. That's why to deal with them. That's why they're completely, you know, virtually powerless and poverty-stricken, and we have everything to give and nothing to lose by just killing them with kindness and just saying, you know what? And in fact, you know what? They say in all their criticism of Trump that, you know, Trump is such a sucker and this guy Kim is such a wily, crafty guy playing fourth dimensional chess here, and he's going to get over on Trump and he's getting all these things and giving up nothing and all this stuff. That even if those caricatures were true, of, I mean, because the guy, you know, he's inherited a totalitarian state. He's a pretty bad guy. He's enforced it so far. But we could just, you know, obviously diplomacy wise, they could just play it like, hey, you're your father's son. You're not him. You're a brand new man, and you can do what you want, and it doesn't have to be this way. And I think that is kind of how they played it in Singapore, right, with that video they made for him and everything, where, you know what, even if he is a carbon copy of his dad, just keep telling him that he's not. And just keep telling him, look at all we have to gain for being friends. And there's no reason to have this crisis at all. It seems like, you know, if Trump, you know, maybe he only didn't go far enough yet. Maybe he should go ahead and end the war and give a permanent security guarantee and give him everything up front. And then get them to disarm as much as possible, but start with taking away their motive to even have nuclear weapons by just being their friend.
Precisely. Yeah, I about Kim Jong Un. He's in his 30s, and the guy is a pretty young, you know, young leadership, and he is, a lot of people, you know, the one main mainstream narrative you get from American media, North Korea cannot be trusted, right? That is one thing. And here I think we should also really even look at the North Korean leadership. All those three leadership, you know, they may not be the most, you know, how to say, likable people, but all of them, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un now, all of them have said one thing consistently, and that is the security guarantee, peace treaty. Just don't, you know, threaten us, specifically United States, right? If you don't threaten us, there's no reason for us to develop a nuclear weapon. And in a way, they just want to be kind of left alone. You know, it's a totalitarian system, but that's the way it is. And there's a lot of, you know, rotten, you know, people on Earth, but they're not, North Korea is not the only one. And you're absolutely right. Just look at China. I mean, China developed, you know, opened its economy, and China is obviously nuclear power. And still you have, you know, this diplomatic and all kind of political relationship with the rest of the world. And if Soviet Union can do, and China can do it, why can't North Korea do? I mean, this is, in a way, it's ludicrous. And the fact that even to entertain the idea that North Korea is, you know, pose a threat to the United States and the entire world, that in itself should be, you know, it really doesn't make sense,
right?
At least to a lot of people. Yeah. So I think this is time, really, I hope that, you know, President Trump, you know, we don't really support him other policies, but on this one, I think he has a momentum. He did, you know, he did the right thing to meet with Kim Jong-un. And most importantly, I think, going back to the original point, that is, this is two Koreas want it, and the President Moon Jae-in won it. President Moon Jae-in, as you know, who was elected with the candlelight revolution. I mean, he's, you know, 80%, 90% of Koreans support the rapprochement. And this is why this time we should really, you know, have a clear, you know, peace process that has conquered results, specifically having signed peace treaty, and then, you know, move forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, you guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, subscribe to the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. All the feeds are available at scotthorton.org and also at libertarianinstitute.org. You can also follow me on youtube.com/scotthortonshow. And sign up for Patreon. If you do, anybody who signs up for $1 per interview gets 2 free books from Listen and Think Audio. And also, you'll get keys to the new Reddit page, reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. And then if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, $20 will get you the audiobook of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 will get you a signed copy of the paperback there. And a $100 donation will get you either a QR code, commodity disc, or a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. That's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And also, anybody donating $5 or more per month there, if you already are, or if you sign up now, you'll get keys to that new Reddit group as well. Already got about 50 people in there, and it's turning out pretty good. Again, that's reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. If you're already donating or you're a new donor, just email me, scott@scotthorton.org, and I'll get you the keys there. And hey, do me a favor, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you liked the book, on Amazon.com, and the audiobook is also on iTunes, and sure would appreciate that. And listen, if you want to submit articles to the Libertarian Institute, please do, and they don't have to be about foreign policy. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
And now, so can we talk a little bit about the details of what the North Koreans have been willing to do so far to show their good faith? I mean, we only have Singapore and some subsidiary talks, but we don't actually have an agreement with them yet. But they've already done some things, like repatriation of remains from the Korean War and some other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, as you can, that they already did, you know, unilaterally, they, you know, implemented nuclear test moratorium, and also they unilaterally, you know, implementing missile test moratorium. As you know, also they closed those Pyongyang nuclear test sites and dismantled key satellite launching sites. As you mentioned, releasing American prisoners. And so what North Korea wants is this. It's a phase-in approach. They would like to get some kind of security, actually strongest possible security guarantee from the United States, which means right now at the two Koreas that are requesting signing a political document, political declaration, saying that, you know, that end Korean War. This is not a full peace treaty. It's sort of interim. It's a prelude to a full peace treaty. The reason, the importance of this is because, it's going to take at least 2 years or so for the full peace treaty that, you know, that has to be also ratified by U.S. Senate, etc. So in the meantime, what are you going to do? If you, right now from North Korea's point of view, if you, let's say, you know, as the way United States wants, they could just say complete denuclearization right now, and then with some kind of promise of, peace treaty later. What that means is that, you know, because two Koreas, Korea is still in the technocratic war, what you're saying is to North Korea, okay, why don't you just, lay down your arms, give up all your arms, and then we'll see, and then, you know, maybe we'll behave, and then we may give you some peace treaty. So that is not really, I don't think that is not reasonable. So North Korea wants phasing approach. They want some kind of interim security guarantee. And then I think that what I'm hearing also from Korean analysts is that they are, with the upcoming Secretary Pompeo's visit, I think it's going to happen in probably soon in September, North Korea is willing to provide all the list of nuclear programs, the weapons, details, facilities, and ICBM and all that. With the exchange of United States signing that political declaration, saying, and Korean War has ended, right? So this is, I think it's possible. And also that President Moon Jae-in has said that signing the political declaration of ending Korean War is the goal of this year, 2018. We're going to sign that. I think China is also supporting it. So I think that is sort of a more short-term goal. And long-term goal, I think North Korea was, again, there's a good chance to know within even, before the next election, U.S. election, North Korea will, especially with Kim Jong-un, I think there's a good chance that he will, with the support of South Korea, and there's a good chance that North Korea will be pretty willing to strike a deal with the United States that can really, acceptable by the Trump administration. So that is my guess. So another way, in a nutshell, at this point, the most important one is giving North Korea the security guarantee that it wants. And even Kim Jong-un, during the summit meeting, inter-Korean summit meeting, not everything were translated, because I was listening to Korean, Kim Jong-un was saying, we don't need a nuclear weapon, something like that. And why would we want nuclear weapon if United States, if there's no threat from the United States? Of course, it's different from individual leaders' remark is different from the sort of state's interest. But nevertheless, I think, going back again and again, is the important point is that giving them security guarantee. I think we'll have them credit pretty acceptable a nuclear deal with North Korea.
Yeah. Well, now, it's not just Bolton, but, even the Trump and the rest of them, they say complete. They even have, initials. I don't know if it's an acronym or not. They have
CBID,
initials for
CBID.
Yeah, the complete denuclearization verification.
Yeah.
So, but what about settling for less than that? What if at the end of, another 18 months of this or so, Kim says, okay, look, I want to hang on to a couple of atom bombs, but you can take down my long-range missiles and, whatever. I'll give up a lot, but I'm not giving up every last A-bomb. And it's certainly good enough for me. I think we should just, make a peace treaty and a security guarantee anyway, and I don't care if they have nukes or not, but I'm not in charge. So I wonder if you think that would just blow up the whole arrangement, or you think, and I know you're keeping close tabs on all these other, experts and wonks looking at this. Do you think that actually that might even be acceptable on the American side after a while, that, you know, okay, maybe you'll still keep a couple of nukes, but at least take down your factories so that you don't make any more and whatever else like that. What do you think?
I think it depends on how it is presented to American public. I think American public might be, you know, this is acceptable to American public. I mean, look at the Pakistan, you know, nuclear power, India nuclear power. Of course, they will say, well, Pakistan is not North Korea. But anyway, you know, those nuclear powers, as long as they are, I mean, abiding by those rules governing nuclear weapons. And up there, another important thing is, even if you are nuclear power, In the case of North Korea, the argument that people are making is, you know, their economy is embedded within the regional economy and also with the rest of the world. And there won't be any incentive for them to, you know, threaten other countries with a nuclear weapon. And I think the difficult thing is, though, I mean, look at this one. The reason why this North Korea is a little bit different is that American security establishment, they cannot accept the fact that they have to, you know, challenged by this small country, like rogue country like North Korea. It is almost like, you know, it hurt ego. And psychologically, it's very difficult to accept the fact that you allow North Korea, like it's a tiny country, you know, 10 million people are at the risk of starvation and hunger, giving them sort of a, you know, sort of equal nuclear power. I think that is, but if you sort of, you know, get over with the psychological sort of barrier, I think it could be acceptable, North Korea. And the more important thing is that, again, the South Korea. I think in this case, you know, this is not about between, again, North Korea and United States, and this is about South Korea, and there is about, you know, 50 million people in the South and their role. And I, again, in this case, when President Moon Jae-in delivered a speech in the last week about National Liberation Day, and South Korea and North Korea in their right to, charter, their right to shape the future is more important than any other issue. So that is for Korea. So I think that it's time for the United States to, you know, take a different perspective on this issue and to really give us some, you know, greater sort of a way to the, you know, respect what the two Koreas are trying to do.
Yeah. All right. Now, here at the end, could you talk a little bit more about the family separations? And then, you know, you have this great article. It's called Sea of Tears, The Tragedy of Family Split by the Korean War. It's at Common Dreams. And we ran it on antiwar.com as well. Where you talk about how difficult it has been and still is for these people, these families that have been separated for decades and decades now, where it's only some very limited number of people are allowed each year to meet and this kind of thing. Can you talk about that? And then I guess you're saying there was recently a big meeting.
Yeah, it started with 1953 when the Korean War was halted. It's about 10 million Koreans were separated in both North and South Korea. And, unlike two Germans, you know, there were some kind of a communication, even when they were divided. There's absolutely no communication line. Let's say, you know, I'm a Korean citizen, right? If I were to say somehow have a communication with North Korea without government approval, I'll go to jail, right? So we have very harsh South Korea's national security laws. You are basically considered enemies of the state. No communication whatsoever between family members. Now, since 1980s, however, attempt to have a family reunion. So, in total, about official reunions about 220 face to face reunions. Now, who are those people and how will they select it? Now, about South Korea start registration of divided family members. Now, a lot of people even don't register because there's a lot of stigma against people from North Korea. So total about 137,000 people have registered, and they say they would like to meet. I'm talking about the South Korea. They say they would like to reunite with their family in North Korea. And that started about mid-1980s. You know, half of those people who registered already died, you know, and without ever having to meet their family. So now we are about since 19, the official one reunion started in 2000. So we are about today, this week's event reunion is 21st. And so this is, as I said, it's the way the Korean government select, it's a lottery system, right? So you get to, you know, this is the one out of, you know, thousands of people, you know, get to select it. And so this year they selected only about, you know, 100, and also 100 from South Korea and then 100 from North Korea. So we're talking about 200 family members, but not all of them could go to participate because they're too old and health problem. And so, and then they will, so this is, as I mentioned in my article, it's only one-time event. They can never meet, you know, they will never have a chance to meet them again. And then there are also about, we're talking about the remaining about some, you know, more than 60,000 divided family who probably will never get to see their loved ones. And also in the United States, we have about some hundred, some thousand Koreans who have a relative in North Korea who could not, you know, who can't visit, who cannot meet there. And especially with the Trump administration put these travel bans on, you know, the visitors to, traveling to North Korea. So this is a humanitarian disaster. And so my hope is that with the opening of this, now resuming this family reunion, and I hope that, I specifically in the article I said the importance of have a regularization of a family reunion. There's a permanent place where a family can go instead of just having to make this long journey to Kumgang Mountain and just get to, you know, meet only once. Just kind of, you know, permanent place. I think that will be great. And also there's another one in the U.S., actually U.S. Congress. There's a Congress resolution that requests the family, you know, travel reunion of Korean Americans in North Korea. So I hope that it's a very good resolution, and I hope that passed both House and Senate so that Korean Americans can participate and have a reunion with their, you know, loved ones in North Korea. So in a nutshell, this is, you know, it's not just about, you know, North Korea, this is about nuclear issue. This is about the most, this is 21st century, the most, you know, tragic history. And I hope that with the, you know, they said Korean words, forgotten war. I hope the Americans this time maybe have a, you know, more understanding. And I really hope that there's a bipartisan support for this peace process. And I truly appreciate that, you know, people like you and those progressives who are doing amazing work, you know, that step for peace in the Korean Peninsula.
All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Simone. I really appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
All right, you guys. That's Simone Chun. She's writing at Common Dreams, and we're republishing at least some of it at NIWAR.com toward a truly indigenous peace in the Korean Peninsula. And also make sure and look at this one, Sea of Tears, the tragedy of families split by the Korean War. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.